PPI.org. Good evening. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Good evening, Charlene.
Good evening, everybody.
Tonight we have Dr. Emil Liu. Dr. Liu will be discussing the topic of pancreatic cancer. Dr. Liu is a PhD of gastrointestinal oncology and assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology and Transplantation at the University of Minnesota Medical School and Masonic Cancer Center. Did I get all that, Dr. Liu?
Absolutely right. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's quite a mouthful.
It is. It's a long list.
Hats off to you. Thank you so much for sharing your time tonight. We appreciate that on this important topic. I want to start out by tell us a little bit about your path to medicine and why you chose this particular field.
Sure. And hello to all your listeners as well joining us and talking about this important topic. So just to give you a little bit of background for myself, I'm both a physician and scientist. I went to medical school and also graduate school and completed a program for a career path that sometimes it's called physician-scientist or hyphen or clinician investigator. And so what this does is allow me or provided me the background to both investigate at the cellular and molecular level, and in this particular type of career, cancers very specifically, the biology of it, all the way to being a medical physician trained in oncology in order to treat patients with cancer. My specific area of focus is gastrointestinal oncology, and pancreatic cancer is one of the more prominent types of cancer. The time that I was in high school and early part of college, my best friend's mother was diagnosed with pancreas cancer, and that was probably one of my earliest exposures to pancreas cancer and the devastation that it can cause personal level. She passed away at the end of our first year of college when we just come back after the completion of our first year of college, and that affected me a lot. And then over the years, I think just like many Americans, either if you're not affected by cancer yourself personally, then it might be someone close to you, family, friend, neighbor, or someone that you know of, as 1 in 2 American men and 1 in 3 American women are diagnosed with cancer. Pancreatic cancer is on the rise in the last few years in this country.
So can you start out by giving us a definition of what pancreatic cancer is and how does it work?
Sure. So the pancreas is an organ in the body that produces hormones and other enzymes or things that help us digest food. So as we know, we eat food through our mouth and it goes through a long pipe called the esophagus that leads into the stomach. And then as our food begins digestion in the stomach, it'll pass through all the rest of the digestive tract, including what we know as the small intestines and colon. And somewhere more in the middle of our body, in the abdomen or our midsection, that organ called the pancreas, it's a kind of a long, rather relatively slender organ sitting across our body horizontally. And it feeds into that digestive system when it produces enzymes, for example, to digest foods pretty commonly. We don't really think anything of it if it's functioning normally. Mm-hmm. We think a lot about it when it's not functioning normally.
Yes.
Other types of hormones pretty commonly are hormones that help us to regulate the blood sugar that we have, that when we ingest food or our liver makes blood sugar that's normally sits at a baseline level, that sugar normally would function to feed our organs, like our brain and our heart, and keep them going. And when cancer develops in the pancreas, then it basically develops a tumor. A tumor is basically an abnormal mass that should not be there, and pancreas cancers are almost always malignant or actually cancerous. That tumor, that growth that shouldn't be there, interferes with the normal function of what this organ called the pancreas does. And so that's just the beginning of the problems that pancreas cancer poses.
Okay. It seems like it's not an equal opportunity, that it hits more of one gender than the next. Like
In general, yeah, it's a cancer that overall was not considered to be one of the more common cancers, but for many reasons we still don't know. In general, as an oncology community, it's on the rise in America and I think abroad as well. Overall, there might be a... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you see it more in males or females?
I think it's about more or less the same, maybe slightly more in males than females. But the reasons for that are not really clear yet, as are most of the potential causes of pancreas cancer.
Do you see any elevation of, as far as like, is it more in Caucasian or in other races? Is there a race?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I think more so in general, the studies that are out there, they report the results of a general population that they would study, but in general, it's higher in the Caucasian population, but in some studies have indicated that it may be African Americans may be at higher risk as well. Some of the potential known causes are, just like many other cancers, tobacco use or smoking cigarettes over a prolonged period of time, years or decades, can increase the risk of development of pancreas cancer at least twofold higher. So in other words, someone would have a 2 times higher risk by being a smoker long term than never having smoked cigarettes. Other potential causes. Mm-hmm.
Is there, like, I know in MS kind of is higher in the Midwest for some mm-hmm. strange reasons. Does pancreatic cancer have a region where it's generally higher, or is it just kind of all across the board anywhere?
It's unfortunately all across America, regardless of race, creed, background, ethnicity, and gender. It seems to be where it is when it is diagnosed. It seems to be prevalent across the board, including region of the country.
So, how is it diagnosed, and are there symptoms? Go ahead. How is it diagnosed, and are there symptoms?
Right. It's one of the most challenging types of cancers, and the way I generally tell patients is, by comparison, some of the few cancers for which we have effective and validated screening tests, for example, for women getting mammographies to screen to try and catch breast cancer early, mm-hmm. or for both men and women, a recommendation to obtain colonoscopies or newer type of test with the intention of finding colon or rectal cancer earlier. Unfortunately, we don't yet have such screening tests that are effective and proven to work for screening for pancreas cancer to detect it early. For that reason, there's a particular challenge in that most cases are found at a more advanced stage, and unfortunately, those advanced stages of the tumors, and if they've already spread, can cause symptoms that often lead to the diagnosis. So there are approximately 45,000 cases expected to be diagnosed in the United States this year. Jeez. Approximately half of them will already be stage 4 at the time of diagnosis. And that could mean that the cancer can go and spread way outside of the confines of where it started, like the liver or the lungs or the bone. Approximately a third are considered tumors that are particularly invasive and maybe surrounding major structures like other organs around there or major blood vessels that would make it unsafe for any surgeon to try and take it out successfully. But only about 10 or 15% are so small enough that you might consider at the time of diagnosis that they're surgically removable. So overall, some of the symptoms that patients might present with would be more vague symptoms like abdominal pain or just general discomfort, what we call malaise, just feeling queasy, things that are not necessarily specific to pancreas cancer, and that can also make the diagnosis complicated because it could be masked or mimic other types of symptoms for things that have nothing to do with cancer.
Right. I want to ask about, are there different types of pancreatic cancer, or is it just all one lump thing?
Right. Speaking as a biologist as well as an oncologist physician who treats the patients, in one sense, globally, if you go on internet search and search pancreas cancer, it comes across as if it's just one disease. But in many ways, I think of it as many multiple forms. And here's what I mean by that. Overall, of those 45,000 cases expected in 2019 that I mentioned, the vast majority of them, up to 90% or more, slightly more, are what are called adenocarcinoma. So I mentioned earlier that pancreas is a hormone-producing organ or producing enzymes and other things that come from glands that compose the pancreas. If those glands become cancerous, that's called under the microscope adenocarcinoma. And that's what we generally think of when we think of someone's been diagnosed with pancreas cancer. Approximately 5 to 10% are called neuroendocrine tumors that at the cellular level are completely different and they behave relatively differently. Although both types of cancer can spread, but the prognosis could be quite a bit different and the behavior of the cells and the tumors could be quite different depending on the diagnosis. Within pancreas carcinoma in general, they might look the same under the microscope, but I also in my clinical practice have seen and in my training that a patient may suffer differently or have different symptoms if the cancer predominantly goes to the liver as compared to if the predominant site that it moves to is the lungs. They can be clinically impacted differently. So in some ways, although it's the same cancer and it started from the same place and it's under the microscope, looks identical, it could have a different impact. And in that sense, I might call it a different type of cancer, the way it behaves based on the characteristics of any individual patient.
So let's talk. I think you're hearing more and more about pancreatic cancer, especially in the media. And there was somebody fairly famous not too long ago who's diagnosed with it. How does it look as far as, is it always terminal?
That's a tough question. It's the great goal of research and clinical trials and lab-based research that I do at the University of Minnesota and many others do across the world is to make what's a very difficult to treat disease and turn it into a cure. At the very least, that's definitely a long-term ideal goal. At the very least, we're trying to take something that 20 to 30 years ago was pretty much considered a death sentence and turn it into at least a disease that we can manage chronically and make it what we would call a chronic disease. The answer to the question of whether or not it's terminal might depend on how you define terminal or would consider each case. If terminal means that someone will ultimately die of the disease, then that is unfortunately the vast majority of cases with pancreas carcinoma. If the patient is in that minority of patients whose tumor, for whatever reason, was found early enough and surgery can be performed, that would be done. The surgery would be done with an intent to cure, was considered a high-risk cancer, but there's a chance, and there's definitely a better chance of rendering someone cancer-free. There's also components of chemotherapy and in certain cases, radiation as well. If someone is diagnosed with stage 4 form of pancreatic adenocarcinoma, as half the cases are at the time of diagnosis, then the goal of chemotherapy that we would give would be palliative in intent. In other words, the chemotherapy, our current technology does not have the capability of eliminating, getting rid of, or curing, however you want to say it, that kind of cancer. But if we can turn it into a chronic disease that would improve the quality of life of the patient, then that would be the ultimate goal in that setting.
So theoretically, if someone was caught early enough and the tumor could be removed, presumably that would be a tumor on the pancreas, yes?
Correct, right.
That had not yet spread. So why not, would they consider just removing the pancreas? Granted, it would leave them diabetic, but hey, I could think of worse things.
Right. Yeah, so in that case, in that 10 to 15% of cases I was mentioning earlier, surgery is done with intent to cure, and the extent of the surgery, and I certainly depend on my surgical expert colleagues on this, could depend on the location of the tumor. So much like our bodies, the pancreas is designated as having different parts. So there's the head, what's called the head of the pancreas, is a part that's more towards the right side of our body and located close to the liver. And if the tumor stems from that area, then someone might have a extensive, not trivial surgery, something that's called a Whipple surgery or Whipple procedure. In that case, an expert surgeon would take out the head of the pancreas, but not the entire pancreas. They'd leave the remaining pancreas intact. And then they might take out parts of the small intestine and the surrounding area to try and get as much as they could. If the cancer is only at the tail, which is on the left side of the body, part of the pancreas, and away from the rest, then maybe the surgeon can get away with taking out the entire tumor but preserving the rest of the pancreas. But on occasion, if the tumor is pretty extensive, there are cases that a surgeon may need to take out much more. And you're exactly right. A patient may get diabetes as a result of the tumor. Sometimes, interestingly enough, the diabetes heralds the diagnosis of pancreas cancer some months in advance. And there's no explanation, but it's only in hindsight when pancreas cancer is diagnosed later that one realizes if the tumor interfered with the normal function of the pancreas, that's why the patient got the diabetes. It's not a reliable marker. It's not the case that everybody gets diabetes has pancreas cancer, but there are cases in which people develop diabetes, and only later do we understand, once the diagnosis has been made, that in hindsight it was caused by that.
I have a question. What exact diagnostic test is used to actually determine the location of the tumor?
That's an excellent question. So initially, the usual course of symptoms would usually lead one to go to, if someone has a primary care provider, whether it be physician assistant or family doctor or internal medicine doctor, with symptoms. And often by the description of symptoms, that might lead to a CT scan or what's commonly called a CAT scan. Occasionally a different type of scan called MRI might be called upon, as it might have higher resolution and clarify. But usually either one of those tests, including a CT scan, which is more common, might show a mass on the pancreas that a radiologist would point out to the doctor, maybe with a call and say, there's a mass on the pancreas that should not be there. And at that point, it would be cancer unless it'd be suspected to be cancer until proven otherwise. And so the critical step to make the diagnosis would be an actual biopsy. And that's often done by an experienced gastroenterologist who would do procedures. He or she would do what's called an endoscopy or endoscopic ultrasound. More specifically, they go down the throat and they have a camera and a probe in which they can take biopsy specimens or samples that they would give to a pathologist who looks in the microscope and confirms, yes, this is cancerous, and the type of cancer is adenocarcinoma or neuroendocrine.
I knew of somebody, an acquaintance, who his father died of pancreatic cancer. His brother was diagnosed a year later. And I think there was another person in his family who was diagnosed. Does it run in families, or can it?
It can, and it's a very common question, because one of the things that we're trained to do in medical school, and especially in the cancer field, is to really ask not just about the patient and as we're treating them, but to ask, is anyone else in the family, has anyone in the family been affected by cancer, biologic relatives, and is there some kind of pattern? I was saying earlier that things like smoking or maybe alcohol abuse or other things that cause chronic inflammation of the pancreas are most strongly linked to being risk factors. Interestingly, only approximately 5 to 10% of pancreas and other similar cancers might be considered hereditary, but it's definitely not trivial if someone is in that 5 to 10% category.
Right.
There are genes that we know about and are being linked to pancreas cancer and increased risk. And I have no doubt there are genes yet to be discovered that someday will enlighten us a little bit more. And that 5 to 10% number might actually rise in the future with discovery of other genes. There are some clusters of family syndromes or genetic syndromes that we know of that perhaps might be, for example, linked to skin cancers, a skin cancer called melanoma. And if that gene might increase the risk of melanoma, it might also increase the risk of pancreas cancer. A common one that's been in the news more recently, even just in the last month, is a gene more associated with breast cancer. Some people have heard of BRCA, or sometimes BRCA. It's called BRCA. There are different forms of BRCA, and there's one form called BRCA2 that, although it's only seen in a small minority of pancreas cancer patients, under 5%, it's definitely present. And sometimes, and I've had patients under my care who tell me stories when they're first diagnosed that other people in their family have had pancreas cancer, but also breast cancer and maybe bile duct cancer, maybe some other cancers. And that sets off some bells in my head that there might be a genetic syndrome, and we might have a cancer genetics team expert meet with the patient to try and delve further into that and use available testing to find that out. So, that would have implication and whether other family members might need to get tested.
Yeah, so I'd like to just stick on this path just for a minute and say, so let's say you had two or three people in the family that did have pancreatic cancer. Presumably you'd test to see if, are they the same? Yes, you would make sure they're the same pancreatic cancers? Because it could be different from each other, right?
Right. So to clarify, you mean whether the person, other person's actually diagnosed with a cancer would be tested, or
well,
people at risk?
You would make sure that the people who had, let's say, three people in a family had pancreatic cancer. You might compare, mm-hmm. like, are these pancreatic cancers the same? And then what would you do with the leftover family members? Would there be any early tests,
sure.
or what would you do?
Sure. To address the first part of that question, sometimes we're limited because, especially from bygone eras, someone might say, especially older patients, that their parents would either be very elderly or no longer alive, mm-hmm. maybe come from an era where the technology was not as good, and maybe the cancer was diagnosed too late, or the there was less information, and frankly, also cancer was more, in some cultures, not allowed to be talked about among families. So sometimes patients will suspect that someone had pancreas cancer, or if it's from the 70s or 80s or 90s, it's not either someone not alive or not much information is known. So that's sometimes of a hindrance. If somebody, for example, might have contemporaries like in their family, siblings or cousins, who in recent years were diagnosed, then there might be an opportunity to do testing on both or multiple individuals. It's a little harder right now to say what exactly can be done for people who are family members, not yet diagnosed, but their family member or biologic relative has been diagnosed with pancreas cancer, what exactly to do. I think we definitely very, very strongly encourage those individuals, if they're tested and found to have potential gene, to have very in-depth conversations with their own physicians to determine the best course. Because we still don't have effective pancreas cancer screening tests, there isn't an exact screening test. Like if a family member had colorectal cancer and then someone had the gene, you would tell them, go get your colonoscopy sooner. Don't wait until the age of 50 or even 45. Maybe you need to do it sooner in your young adulthood, mm-hmm. to because you would be at higher risk. Because there still is no effective pancreas cancer screening test, that's a little harder, but it certainly is worth consideration about potentially considering ways to screen for it in those individuals who are at higher risk.
Is there a general age that this is diagnosed at?
It's, the average age, surprisingly, would be older than I would think, based on what I see in my clinic. The average or the median age is generally in the 55 to 65 range,
okay.
nationwide, but I've had patients who are in their early to mid-20s diagnosed and all the way till early 90s and treated or been the physician for those patients and any age in between. Exactly why, it still remains a mystery in the medical community, especially as we're seeing a higher risk of many types of cancers, not just pancreas, but colon and rectal and others, mm-hmm. in what we consider the young adult population. Mm-hmm. And that's overall on the rise in the last few decades compared to the last half of the 20th century.
It makes you wonder what environmental thing has gone on that is producing this or causing maybe higher cancer.
Exactly.
I think I've heard about studies, Dr. Liu, involving vitamin D. And mm-hmm. can you talk a little bit about that? And does that affect things? If so, how? And what are you guys doing with that?
Right. Yeah, I'd bundle that with A, B, C, the whole alphabet soup of vitamins and many other things and even further supplements of that. So I guess one aspect of that would be, does deficiency of certain vitamins, especially vitamin D, lead to increased risk of cancer? And there has been some evidence to support that. In some respects, for every study that comes back and says that definitely is, there might be an equal and opposite research study from legitimate researchers and institutions to say the opposite too. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. Vitamin D is an interesting vitamin in particular, because it's something that we ingest in our food. It's milk is often fortified with vitamin D, especially mm-hmm. for children, and then it's activated when we get exposure to sunlight. And in some research studies, the deficiency of it will increase broadly our risk of cancer. When someone is diagnosed with cancer, they typically have, in our clinic, people will ask questions that, what can I do for myself? So, and I often say, well, if you're a smoker, stop smoking, limit your alcohol intake. But also, I think a common question is, well, if I take vitamin D or certain other vitamins, would that help combat or treat my cancer? To date, there really isn't any firm evidence to state that it would, but I think so many Americans, especially in Minnesota here, where our sun exposure is limited many months of the year.
Oh, yeah.
We tend to be vitamin D deficient. We spend much of our time indoors, whether at desks or not. So in general, for overall health, it's the risk to benefit aspect is no harm in taking a vitamin D supplement. But in general, I would more focus on dietary intake, having a balanced diet of proteins and carbohydrates, and also exercise, I think, is something that's all too overlooked, but it's very crucial. In fact, over vitamin levels and actual nutrition diet type of concerns, I'd say there's probably the most amount of data supporting the role of exercise in cancer survivorship and the ability of patients to better tolerate the chemotherapy treatments that they undergo. But the vitamin question is still an outstanding question that it's somewhat controversial in the field of cancer, but a lot of research being done there.
Let's talk about treatments. Talk a little bit about what the treatment is and how it works.
Mm-hmm. So the treatment going from the category of patients whose tumor is localized and contained within the pancreas, the standard of care for more than a dozen years has been the attempt at surgery, wherever the cancer might be located, and often followed by approximately or up to 6 months of chemotherapy. In that situation, the role of chemotherapy would be to try and get rid of and quash or eradicate and kill off any microscopic cells that are inevitably left behind, in order to decrease the risk that would come back and hopefully to have patients live longer and hopefully cancer-free. The foundation of that approach would be the surgery. But I think definitely the experience compared to prior to the 20th century was a surgery alone, and not the unacceptably high number of cases would come back. Unfortunately, the vast majority of cases are not that. It's 80% or more where the tumor is either wrapped around major structures that do not allow us to have surgery performed front, or half of all cases where the cancer has not only escaped the pancreas but got into the bloodstream and spread to other sites. That's been the cancer terminology would be called metastasis, meaning spread far away from where it started. That's equivalent to saying stage four, in which those type of cancers of pancreas carcinoma are not curable, but the purpose of chemotherapy is palliative in intent. In other words, to make someone feel better, to improve their quality of life as compared to not doing the chemotherapy. The actual drugs that are used, most of which go through the vein, are pretty similar, whether it's the scenario where it's being given after a surgery or if surgery cannot be performed for any reason. The drugs themselves are pretty similar, and the pancreatic cancer community worldwide has made a lot of progress based on clinical trials just in the last decade in increasing the number of options we have to treat patients with new combinations and actual new drugs for pancreas cancer that work effectively.
I was going to say, I've kind of been told that there's not, if you look at breast cancer, there's a lot of chemotherapies. There are choices of that, combinations of stuff to use on that, where I've kind of been told that pancreatic cancer, there's not nearly as many. Is this true, and why would that be?
Right. I think relatively to, for example, compared to breast cancer, you're absolutely correct. I think some of the unique biologic features, I'll use both breast cancer and even the more common form of lung cancer called non-small cell lung cancer. When I was in training at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City more than a decade ago, entering that period, we just thought of someone being diagnosed with lung cancer. And if you want to be more specific, it's non-small cell lung cancer. Or if someone was diagnosed with breast cancer, it was breast cancer. What do you do for breast cancer? And the evolution of the field of cancer treatment has been rather remarkable in the last decade, decade and a half, where it's not just, it's only the beginning of the categorization. So we end up splitting based on the properties of the cell under the microscope, but also advanced techniques to find out what genes might be driving, what proteins might be deriving from those genes, and then how those cancers actually present different subtypes. That way it's important to an oncologist like myself making a treatment decision is we have more options for treatment that actually target specific subtypes. So to give you an example from lung cancer, approximately 5% of that category called non-small cell lung cancer are driven by a gene that's similar to a type of leukemia. It's called ALK, or ALK for short. Mm-hmm. There, in recent years, there is a drug that can be taken to target that, to go against that target and work quite effectively to treat that form of cancer. And if that target is seen in other types of cancers, it may also work effectively. But it should not, it would not work effectively or not expected to work effectively in the other 95%. So that is a 5%, sounds small, but it's very important to that 5% of patients who have that exact subtype.
Right.
Pancreas cancer has presented much more of a biological dilemma, which many, many researchers are still trying to overcome. We've not yet identified very specific subsets at the genomic or cellular level with pancreas cancer like we have with breast cancer and lung cancer, as I specified. That's limited the type of treatment options that can be given. We're also familiar, whether people see in advertisements or on the internet, reading about types of cancers like what are called targeted therapy or molecular therapy or immunotherapy. And it's a pretty common question. People will come in saying, well, I know somebody who has cancer. They're getting, they'll name a type of therapy. And I'll ask further, what kind of cancer are they getting treated for? And I have a pretty similar discussion that I have now. The type of chemotherapies that are given for pancreas cancer, are there things that have been around for decades but maybe using new combinations or new reformulations of drugs or actually new drugs altogether that have been perhaps using other types of cancers or perhaps using new combinations that have gone through years-long clinical trials that are shown to be better than what previously existed as standard of care, and they've entered the repertoire of what we can use. But you're absolutely right. The actual number of actual drugs that we're using for pancreas cancer, it's much higher than it was a decade ago, but compared to some other types of cancers, we have a long way to go.
Could you talk a little bit about, and I'm sure I'll explain this incorrectly, so my apologies, but there's something to do with how when there is pancreatic cancer, how the cancer is that actually part of your body forms around it, part of your cells form around it, and it makes almost a shell around it, and it's hard, and it makes it difficult for other drugs and stuff to permeate it or to tell that it's to break it down so it's they can get to the cancer. It's like your body's almost fighting against it because it's protecting mm-hmm. that cancer. Am I saying that right? How do you?
I think you gave an excellent description of that conundrum. So the important thing to view tumors, and I'm kind of putting on my biologist hat.
Okay.
And it's also a great reminder for even doctors and other oncologists and or students of medicine to understand is that when we often refer to these entities called tumors as just cancer, but they're actually very heterogeneous. They're made of so many different types of cells. So someone who has a cancerous tumor, it's not the case that 100% of it is just cancer cells. It's some composition, it could be half or less than half even, of cancer cells, but then all these other things that are either like structural scaffolds or maybe help to feed the cancer cells or maybe blood vessels that the cancer cells will form to nourish themselves, all become part of this, what we call the tumor microenvironment. And pancreas cancer, this is true across many types of cancers, but it's particularly challenging in pancreas carcinoma because pancreas cancer really knows how to do this very, very well. I think the word you'd use to describe a shell brings to mind something that's really hard and almost cloaking like a fortress. And that's exactly right. That's exactly what pancreas cancer does. It's a very insidious disease, and it's ahead of the game before we can even diagnose it. It's already laid for itself a very fertile environment, and that can take this shape where the cancer cells settle themselves in a very hard, like a physically hard environment that might also make it hard for the surgeon to take it out effectively. But it also is great fertile soil for the cancer to grow uninterrupted. In other words, our immune system might not be able to recognize it early enough. And even if it were to attack, it wouldn't be able to penetrate that shell. We're having a lot of difficulty in some cases more than others, and we're not yet sophisticated enough to be able to predict this ahead of time, but we're making progress, that sometimes you give chemotherapy and it's very clear on subsequent CT scans that it's getting into the tumor very well. Maybe the tumor shrinks. And other times, the chemotherapy or drugs have a hard time getting in by penetrating the shell. And we speculate that if only it could make it into the actual core of the tumor inside the cancer, it would probably work effectively. But it's reaching a barrier that it can't pass, and that's why the drug doesn't work effectively. There have been recent approaches, and again, trying different strategies that or maybe are not commonly used for breast or lung cancer, the other examples I gave earlier where targeted therapies are effective. But some drugs designed not to attack the actual cancer cells, but to attack that shell and try and break it down and erode that shell, that would then allow the other chemotherapy drugs to infiltrate much better and work more effectively.
So theoretically, immunotherapy probably wouldn't work in this case because...
At the current time, I'd have to say yes. It's and if it did, it would be extreme minority, especially compared to other types of cancers that immunotherapy, as the way we're thinking about immunotherapy the last few years, is working exceptionally well, such as melanoma, skin cancer, some forms of lung cancer. We've not yet seen that success, but there are many types of clinical trials and lab-based research trying to cover that question about how to... Can we manipulate pancreas cancer by treating it with something else to make it more susceptible to immunotherapy? That's a very active and exciting and hopeful area of research as well.
What is the length of time one is generally given when they've been diagnosed?
It could. I think the ability to perform surgery if the tumor is localized would certainly affect prognosis. And the prognosis generally, on average, and I'll qualify that with an asterisk in a moment, on average, it would be better for those patients whose tumor is caught earlier, localized at the time of diagnosis, and able to have surgery performed. If patients have widespread cancer, and it could depend on where it's spread, the purpose of chemotherapy and the ability of chemotherapy is rather limited. As I said, it can't take it away, and prognosis might not be expected to be as good. But in my own practice, I've learned never to, when I first meet someone, to unless they want to know statistics, and I tell them, even if they do, that these clinical trials produce statistics talking that calculate an average of hundreds and maybe even thousands of patients, but no individual person is a statistic. And so I've been very pleasantly surprised by patients with stage 4 metastatic pancreas cancer living for years. And I wish I could scientifically discover what exactly was unique and different about their pancreas cancer compared to those who unfortunately did not live more than a few months after diagnosis. But that's also provided a lot of hope. And so in a discussion with patients, I make it a personal discussion and try to provide the extent of information that they want to hear. And if they do wish for statistics, which I provide, I qualify by saying, you're not a statistic, but maybe you can beat the odds.
So when one comes in and is diagnosed, what are the steps you do? What do you is the family worked with? What should happen when one comes in and they're diagnosed?
Sure. Well, one of my greater fears is if someone does not have family or friend or other type of support, it could be logistically more challenging, both from a physical and emotional and mental standpoint. In terms of undergoing treatment and being able to do well through it. I'm actually thrilled when patients come in, majority tend to do with either a spouse or a significant other, children, family members, or friends or neighbors, or I've had many people bring their people from church or other religious faith organizations, someone to help them and to be their eyes and ears and to help them absorb what's a very impactful and very emotionally fraught time. So I think first and foremost, we try and provide a lot of reassurance, more than just medical details, which can always be shared any visit. Just trying to provide someone hope that by the end of the visit, by the time they leave, if they leave with a smile, or the idea that I heard the diagnosis of pancreas cancer, this is devastating. Is there hope for me? And I hope that they would leave with more hope than they came in with. And I think logistically and setting up plans and just trying to show that we've done our homework. I usually try to know as many of the details and request whatever tests are needed before I meet a patient. So that way, by the time they leave, we have 100% of a plan that we could set in place if they choose to go forward with us as their care team. And so we have a great team at the University of Minnesota and in our Masonic Cancer Clinic. I often tell folks I'm the oncologist. I'm probably the least important person on the team. We have fantastic nurses and basically an army of physician assistants and nurse practitioners who patients see on a very routine, regular basis prior to the chemotherapy treatments. We have social workers who are superb, our cancer genetics team. We have a palliative care team. These are board-certified physicians and experts who are there for anything and everything that's bothersome to the patient. And that might be physical symptoms like pain or trouble with digestion or nutrition, but it can also be emotional or mental things. And so the role of the family, I see, is integral more than any other medical specialty I can think of, mm-hmm. is that the family, or and I'll include in that friends or church members or whomever a patient would identify as their strongest source of support, for them to be present and to be of strength for them. I can't see that as being any different than the chemotherapy treatment or anything else that we do in the clinic. It's integral and it's vital to the potential success the patient will have.
Can you talk about studies? What is it? Talk about how they work and how does somebody get involved?
Sure. So they're often referred to by different names. Most commonly, you might hear the term clinical trials, mm-hmm. clinical research, clinical studies, and the terms, all of which I mentioned, can also be very imposing because it somehow implies that someone's being experimented on. So it's very important to, as a foundation of understanding, that it's something that what we call informed consent, that someone mm-hmm. has to not just acknowledge or be aware, but ensure that something might be offered to them, but no one should ever feel an obligation to enroll in these. But for cancers that are still remain very challenging to treat, we don't have broad sweeping potential cures, clinical trials are especially critical and vital to moving the field forward and to improving patient outcomes, including very much so in pancreas cancer. And I include some other cancers I treat in that basket as well. But because we're just trying to find something better than what we already have. I mentioned in the very first part of our conversation that when I was growing up in New York, my mom's best friend was getting treated with pancreas cancer, and she would fly down to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland every few weeks mm-hmm. for a drug that at the time was experimental on a clinical trial, but has now been around and prevalent for the last 20 years as very routine standard of care and remains one of the treatment options. The treatment options I mentioned also throughout today's conversation that even when I began practice were not valid treatment options, all became so, were approved by the United States FDA because they went through clinical trials where patients were volunteers and volunteered to get one drug treatment or another. And then once those results were assessed, that they were found that, yes, this combination is better than what previously existed. This is entering the options as a new standard of care. Overall, in the United States, for cancer clinical trials, as oncologists and cancer centers, we need to do a much better job of educating the public of what trials are and bringing clinical trials to our centers. And the Masonic Cancer Clinic, the Mayo Clinic at the University of Minnesota stand out among many people's minds, but also many of the regional partnerships among the community oncology practices have access to community clinical trials that are nationwide brought here to the regions, not just in the metropolitan Minneapolis-St. Paul area, but throughout the state of Minnesota, including through the Minnesota Clinical Trials Network, to make this more accessible, because it's important because we want to provide the best treatment possible. Mm-hmm. And for cancers like pancreas cancer, we want to see at least offer the option that patients can have to have something more than just standard of care. This is what moves the needle forward to get better treatment.
My friend who had pancreatic cancer used to look for clinical trials, and she would fly to places to be in them or to be assessed if she was able to be in them. It seems to me that that could weigh very heavy on the family financially and otherwise. Is there anything that helps pay that or support that?
That's a great point. It's something of increasingly being recognized among the medical community as it really should be. There's actually a term that's developed over time and used more commonly now. One called it's called financial toxicity, because mm-hmm. we often think of the toll that pancreas and other types of cancers take on the body and also the mind and the spirit, but the toll that this takes on the patient and family and how much it costs. As oncologists, we're not routinely thinking minute to minute that the patient has a three-hour chemotherapy infusion and how much does it cost for parking or the gas to come here, whether someone's coming from a few miles away, or sometimes my patients will come from several hours away on a very routine basis to get chemotherapy treatment or other forms of treatment or just for routine checkups. The goal of any facility providing clinical trials is to provide clinical trials that fit the population of the patients that they treat. Some of the challenges of clinical trials is that there are different types of clinical trials, and there's often a long list of a checklist that's designed to ensure, above all, safety. Mm-hmm. So if someone has a type of cancer and the clinical trial enrolls patients with that cancer, it doesn't make one automatically eligible. From a biologic standpoint, it may, for example, some trials are reserved for patients who've exhausted all available standard of care options that are already available by any oncology team, and then and only then can someone enroll in a certain clinical trial. Some other clinical trials are for patients who are newly diagnosed, but if someone gets a different form of treatment and then comes, for example, to me and I have that trial, unfortunately, I would not be able to offer that. So those are just some examples of eligibility. And yes, I think it's very challenging if someone has a clinical trial it needs a clinical trial, but the trial is not available in their immediate geographic area. It can take a physical toll and as well as a financial toll to fly to another city, another state to seek that clinical trial. Clinical trials also provide very close oversight, and often the visits and the testing is often more frequent than would be the standard of care, and that can increase all of those types of toxicity that I mentioned, financial and otherwise. So they all present challenges, but certainly our goal here is to have as many clinical trials as possible for the patients that we treat. Some of the logistics of clinical trials, because they're expensive to run, is that there's a preset number of patients that we can enroll, and sometimes logistically there have to be some amount of time after enrolling any given number of patients before we can enroll anymore, mostly out of safety evaluations to ensure that no one's being harmed by anything that we're doing. And so one of the other challenges is patients come to our center or many others seeking a clinical trial, and they're in need that week or within a couple of weeks of a trial, but perhaps we have a trial or another center might have a trial, but not a spot to offer that week. And that's really hard. If we can't offer it when it's needed all the time.
This feels like a very tricky part of the, we want you for clinical trials, but fill in the blank.
And absolutely. Absolutely. It's certainly a tremendous logistical operation, and they're certainly very expensive to operate. So they're often funded by either grants or partnerships with pharmaceutical industries whose drugs are being provided, and mm-hmm. they sponsor the clinical trials. But also it's always a constant, very intensive assessment of safety to ensure that the patients who are enrolled. The mantra of medicine in general globally is first do no harm. And
right.
So the greatest fear that I think any oncologist would have, or any care member team of a team would have, is to ensure that we're not doing harm by doing the clinical trial for any given patient.
How do people find out about these clinical trials?
So certainly, if someone's already a cancer patient and asking your oncologist, there are a number of different internet sites. For pancreas cancer in particular, there are some excellent advocacy organizations. Nationwide, there's the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, which is a fantastic advocacy network that's been around for a couple decades. And the local chapter here in Minneapolis-St. Paul area is tremendously active and supportive of all pancreatic cancer patients and families. The short version acronym of that organization is PanCan or PanCan.org. They have a hotline where patients can call up or families can call up for more information and to be steered towards clinical trials. The National Institutes of Health has an official website accessible to all called clinicaltrials.gov. It's clinicaltrials as compact as one word, .gov. And one can search by state, type of cancer, the type of cancer center, and whatnot. But all this is because there's a lot of medical jargon involved, it can be very complicated and overwhelming for patients to navigate. Many centers, including ours, have patient navigators who are support the patient, not from a chemotherapy drug or physical exam type of standpoint, but really to help them navigate the medical system, mm-hmm. which in and of itself can be overwhelming. And that includes
yes.
helping to steer patients towards physicians like myself who might be able to offer clinical trials. But certainly if someone were to come and is under the care of a physician in the region, or even as we get many patients from not just other parts of Minnesota, but also North Dakota, South Dakota, Northern Iowa, or Western Wisconsin, or even farther, they might come. And if it's come to our attention they're looking for clinical trials or they tell us such, then we try and turn over every stone that we can, especially if we have a clinical trial to offer at our center. But if it's elsewhere, we can help point in the right direction as well.
So I wonder, you talked about how, at least in the last decade, there's been some great progress with treatments for pancreatic cancer. And sometimes it feels like movement in the, you know, forward in the treatment area can be so slow for some cancers. Obviously, they might be harder to treat, but is there a sense of like how much money gets put toward that particular cancer? And I'll take, for example, breast cancer, where a lot of money is put towards that. And,
right.
You know, I wouldn't begrudge that, obviously, but there might be some other cancers out there where, I mean, how does that break down funding-wise?
Right. Even going even further, you're right, and breast cancer is one of the more common cancers, but it has, I think, a superb example of very high-level organized advocacy organizations that are very active in raising money. The Pancreatic Cancer Action Network that I mentioned earlier is just one of many locally, regionally, or nationally who also raise a lot of money. Stand Up to Cancer from the Hollywood community also raise a lot of money, including for pancreatic cancer-specific research. There are different stages of research. Some it's people, including people who work for me in my lab, look under the microscope itself that are not immediately on the horizon for altering new drugs for patients when I go to clinic. And the other end of the spectrum is actually funding clinical trials. It's a tremendously, research in general is a tremendously expensive enterprise. And I'd say many of my research colleagues would agree that a lot of our time is spent trying to raise the money and, for example, putting proposals together to get grants to fund the research. And that takes sometimes much of our time away from actually doing the research or the clinical trials that we would hope to do. So because resources are precious, we have to be a little more cautious and think. You're absolutely right. Science is slow, and even the aspect of clinical trials can be slow. Some of the clinical trials, when we go to, as oncologists, to major oncology organization conferences, and new results are released, and sometimes it's made public in nationwide news and press releases, I always keep in mind, or I tell trainees, that sometimes the idea for that clinical trial, we're hearing the end result, but the idea probably ruminated in someone's mind's eye 10 or 12 years ago. And by the time they got funding and were able to go through
KPI.org.